Let's see if we can make some progress here in the second chapter of Daniel tonight. Now, in the second chapter of Daniel, the second crisis that Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego have encountered takes place. Who can tell us what the first crisis was, the crisis they had in the first chapter? All right, the matter of diet and the food that they wanted them to eat from the king's table, which was a violation of the Jewish laws having to do with food being offered to idols. Also, of course, it was very important as far as testimony was concerned. And so they took their stand. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. And God delivered them and made it possible for them to have vegetables and water. Vegetables doesn't mean that they were served in an old bowl or anything that way. They were served royally, cooked best, and I'm sure they had some of the best eaten that there was in Babylon as vegetarians. But that was the only way they could be sure that they weren't violating some of the dietary laws, because the meats and all were all offered to idols. That's an interesting thing, because you think, why didn't they offer their vegetables to idols? That's what Cain did, you know, or wanted to offer them to the Lord, and the Lord wouldn't receive them. But animals, it's always the shedding of blood. And even in the heathen cultures, that just keeps recurring in heathen cultures all over the world, even today. But certainly in that day, is this matter of the shedding of blood. And that figures into this, I'm sure, as well. But now, in the second chapter, we have the second crisis, and this one is a life and death crisis for sure. For Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. It says in verse 1, he dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep brake from him. Now, this Nebuchadnezzar, and I hope that we'll get this, and I hope I'll learn more about him as we go through chapter 4. We run out of Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, run into Belshazzar. But Nebuchadnezzar reigned for 44 years and was a most unusual king. You see, he is the head of gold. And you don't separate a king and his empire. And you neither do you separate a king and his gods. Because these three things went together in these countries, these eastern nations. King, whoever he was, like, for instance, he was a Chaldean, and Marduk was the god of the Chaldeans, and Marduk is the god of gold. And so it would be proper that he would be the head of gold. And all these things would tie right together, their religion and his kingship, and everything else. And so Nebuchadnezzar puts the wise men who weren't so wise on the spot in this chapter. And so let's look at this. The king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dream. So they came and stood before the king. Now this was the common occurrence whenever there was some something like a dream to be interpreted, or some mystery to be unraveled, or something like that. And that's why he had these people there. By the way, Nebuchadnezzar himself was of the Chaldeans. So that's one of the sections of that Babylon, down in that southern part of it and eastern part of it. So he has these coming sorcerers. They practice witchcraft and all kind of things of that nature. And of course, the astrologers studied the stars and so forth. And it was some of these kind of people from these parts of the world that came to Bethlehem looking. They'd seen a star in the east and came searching for Christ at the time of his birth. And so the king said unto them, I've dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Now, as we've said about Nebuchadnezzar, he didn't necessarily have the largest army that any king ever had. he didn't rule over the largest portion of the world. The Roman Empire was much broader, and so was the Grecian and the Medo-Persian. All the empires after that were larger than his, but his was quality, gold, the best, quality, and his leadership as a king. Now, he had some weaknesses. One of them was a quick temper. You know, in the third chapter, we're going to see where he wanted to put the three Hebrew children in the fiery furnace, and because they wouldn't bow, and how hot-tempered he was about that. Well, we'll see in this same chapter that same spirit. But it seems obvious that Nebuchadnezzar, he's only been on the throne now for, it says, in the second year, he would have been on the throne close to another year of his father's reign, when he was actually the one that was running things. So it's the second year of his own reign, and that's the reason the difference. In some places you have Daniel and the other three other people in training for 3 years. So the question comes, did this event take place after they graduated from their 3 years of training, or did this event take place before they had graduated? Personally, my personal feeling is that this was probably very soon after that graduation, because of the fact that the king listened to Daniel when Daniel asked for time to interpret this dream. He gave him the time. And it says back in chapter 1 that he'd found Daniel and his Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be 10 times better than all the other astrologers and so forth, of wise men of the kingdom. And so, personally, I think that this was after, you see, because after they had finished their 3 years of training, they had to take their final exam under Nebuchadnezzar. And they came before him and were questioned, and they had to pass. So this is very likely after that this takes place. So the king said, I've dreamed a dream, and I'm troubled. When you got a king that's got the authority and power and hot temper of Nebuchadnezzar, and he's troubled, you better walk lightly. And that's exactly what we see here, because it seems as if Nebuchadnezzar didn't trust these so-called wise men anyway. Maybe because he'd just been on the throne a couple of years. Maybe he had observed them. He doesn't seem to be afraid of them, and that's one of the qualities of Nebuchadnezzar that's unusual, because most kings were afraid of these wise men, because these wise men claimed to be representative of the gods, and the gods were the ones who control the events and control the affairs of nations. And so these wise men were usually ones that were listened to, adhered, and you didn't threaten them like Nebuchadnezzar does. But Nebuchadnezzar is ready to clean out the whole bunch of them at this time. Now, so they said in verse 4, tell thy servants the dream, and we'll show the interpretation. Now, folks, that's normal. You can study other places in Scripture and so forth, and that's normal. Joseph, they'd tell Joseph the dream, and Joseph would interpret the dream. That's the way it worked. In prison, whenever he interpreted the butler and the baker's dreams, they told him what their dream was. He told them what the interpretation was. When later on, Pharaoh had the dream about the 7 years of a drought that was coming, and then first the 7 years of plenty, and then the 7 years of drought. Pharaoh told the dream to Joseph, and then Joseph gave the interpretation. So now, these Chaldeans and other folks are there. They are not being unreasonable. The standard procedure was, and always had been, that the king, or whoever it is that dreamed, told the dream, and then they interpreted it. They had books and charts and all kinds of things, that this meant that and this meant this, and they go to their books and they get them all down, and they take all the parts of the dream and they go through the books and say, well, he dreamed this, well, this would mean this, he dreamed this, and this would mean this, and they'd get together and put together an interpretation. You know, and that's the way it worked. Now, obviously, most of them probably weren't accurate interpretations, but they got by with it, and they'd always gotten by with it. But now Nebuchadnezzar says, I want you to tell me the dream first and then give me the interpretation. Now, the question comes, as we're going to see here, as to whether or not he had forgotten the dream or whether or not he was holding the dream back from them because he wanted to find out if they had any kind of real power or contact with the gods. Was anything to them or not? And Nebuchadnezzar was wanting to know that as a part of this. So they said, tell thy servants the dream, and we'll show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. Let me read in the translation that Showers has in this particular connection. The king answered and said to the Chaldean, the command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb. And so on. Now, in other words, this phrase can be interpreted, as we talked about last week, the command for your death has gone forth, and it's a firm command. And if you don't tell me the dream and the interpretation, you're going to all die. Well, that certainly was the thrust of what he had to say, but the question still is here, and nobody's going to answer till we get to heaven and find out as to whether or not the king was withholding it or whether he just actually had forgotten it. Now, really, it makes no difference as far as the purpose is concerned, because in either case, it was working so that Daniel would be the one that would interpret the dream, and he would get this interpretation from God, and it would stand Daniel in good stead. Matter of fact, it made him the second ruler of the kingdom because of this. And the other boys became heads of different departments. So God is working, you see, providence. You know, I've been just got through reading the book of Esther again, and the book of Esther is one book in the Bible, the word God's not in it. Did you know that? The word God's not in the book of Esther. And yet, you find more of God in the book of Esther than you do a lot of other books. I mean, his providence is there in every chapter in the book. I mean, he waked the king up at night. Then he caused the king to remember about somebody who had reported that two men were going to kill him. Then Haman's there at the right time for him to honor Mordecai, and so forth. Just every step of the way through the book of Esther, you see the providence of God. And that's certainly true in this situation, because that's true all the way through the book of Daniel, by the way, and it certainly is true here. God is setting this thing up for Daniel. So it really makes no difference whether he'd forgotten it or he was trying to get rid of these wise men. In either case, that's what it boils down to. But now in verse 6, he said, but if ye show the dream. Now he said in verse 5, he says, if you don't do it, then you shall be cut in pieces and your houses shall be made a dunghill. Now that word dunghill can mean any kind of place of refuse. So it could have been made a public toilet. It could have been just completely destroyed or whatever. But in either case, they're going to destroy it. He said, but if ye show the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Now, so he put something on each side of the scale. He said, if you don't show me the dream, I'm going to cut you all to pieces. If you do show me the dream, then I'm going to honor you. I'm going to lift you up, and because I'll know that you know something and that you're in contact with the gods. Okay? Pretty smart. If you're wanting to find out if these fellows are the real thing or not. And they said again, they answered again in verse 7 and said, let the king tell his servants the dream and we will show the interpretation of it. They thought he just didn't understand. I mean, he's asking the impossible. He's asking something that no soothsayer or astrologist or any wise men had ever been asked before. I mean, this is not the ordinary. And so they just kind of assume, well, he didn't understand it, and he'll tell us the dream is time. And so they asked him to tell the dream. And verse 8, the king answered and said, I know of certainty that you would gain the time, because you see the thing is gone from me. Now, there again, this same phrase, the thing is gone from me, can mean the law or the command to kill all the astrologers and the soothsayers and so forth, or it can be interpreted just like it is here. I've forgotten it. It's gone from me. You realize it's gone from me, so now you're just trying to stall for time. It's what you're trying to do, hoping that maybe it'll come back to me or something else. But he said, I know you're trying to gain the time, verse 9, but if ye will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you, for ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that ye can show me the interpretation thereof. Fellas, he says, this is the way it's going to be. Now, you've just been lying, and you've been telling me all kind of tales, and I don't know whether you've been giving me good interpretations, and I don't know whether I should listen to you, but if you can tell me the dream, then I'll know you're for real, and I will believe the interpretation. Okay. Chaldeans answered before the king, and I think they stepped forward because he was a Chaldean, and they were too. They were of that section of the country. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. You've asked the impossible. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. And they're telling the truth. That just was more than had ever been asked. That's just not part of our job description. We don't have that ability. Now, verse 11, and it is a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Now, this is quite an admission by these fellows, because they had come under the pretense of being representative of the gods, getting their messages from the gods and their answers from the gods. But now, he said, look, the gods we know don't give us those kind of answers. They don't come forth with that kind of thing. So he said, if they know any answers, they're not telling them. And that's just more than has been asked. Now, verse 12, for this cause the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. He said, okay, fellas. The command goes out, get out there, and start killing them. And that's it. That's all it had to be. There wasn't any jury trials or any appeals before the court. No lawyers there, Bill. I don't know. That fellow needed some help, but this man wasn't listening to anybody speak for them either. Now, the decree went forth, verse 13, that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. So they took them, and they started out. Now, there's one fellow I was reading in this, and he indicates that the tense of the verb shows that probably some of them got cut up in pieces before Daniel stopped this thing. In other words, that they went out and started it. Others say that they probably were gathering them together to one particular place to slay them. See, rather than just wherever they found them, bringing them to one particular place. But in any case, they came to Daniel's room, and he and his three friends were studying or whatever it was they were doing in the government business, and Arioch said, "Come on, fellas, I'm going to cut you in pieces. How'd you like to have the door open, somebody step in and tell you that?" But that's exactly what happened. And Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom. Now, while we constantly see this man, Daniel is a quality person. I mean, he controls himself. He doesn't let his emotions get away from him. Even though they've come in here now to take him out, to cut him up in pieces, he knows that throwing a fit, pitching a temper tantrum, or doing something like that's no good. He's got to use wisdom. He's got to counsel. In other words, find out what this thing is about. And so it says, with counsel and wisdom, he answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was going forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. That's the tense of where he says, one of the men say that it indicates that he had already probably killed some of them. Verse 15, he answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree so hasty from the king?" Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. This is the first they'd heard about it. They didn't know a thing about it up to this point. Now that shows, and some say this shows and indicates that they hadn't finished their training period yet. Well, that may be so. Or it just may be that whenever these wise men were called, they didn't consider these young fellows there, because they're just 19, 20 years old at this point. Didn't figure that they were wise enough or had any help that they could offer in this situation. So Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. Now here we see Daniel acting in faith. Here we see him exercising faith. First of all, to go in unto the king. This king has just sent out a decree to kill these folks, including Daniel. And he's in no good mood. And he has absolute authority. And whoever he wants killed, he kills. And whoever he lets stay alive, he lets stay alive. But Daniel goes in before the king, gets an audience with the king, convinces the king to give him a little time. And he said, "I will give you the answer." Now, here is where I think it shows what the king thought of Daniel and why I believe very likely that Daniel had already come in past his exam, because the king seemed to be familiar with him and seemed desirous to not have to kill him like the others that he was seeing desires to kill. Now there seems to be a desire to give him time to answer this dream and to give the interpretation of it. And so this is, you can imagine this young fellow as he goes in before the king and asks for time. Now notice, he said he would show the king the interpretation. And yet he doesn't know the interpretation. He knows God has to give it to him if he gets it. So this is a step of faith. But he, I'm sure, in faith said, "Lord, you didn't bring us here and put us through all you put us through and take care of us just to get us cut up in pieces by this king on a spur of a moment. And Lord, you can solve this, you can answer this, you can give us the answer that we need." And I believe that before we see the prayer time is coming up, But I think there was already some prayer time. I think Daniel went in to see the king with prayer in his mind and in his heart, very much like we see Nehemiah when he went in before the king. You remember in that first chapter, and he said, I said to the king, how did he say it? I prayed to my God and I said to the king. In other words, he's talking to God and talking to the king at the same time. Lord, give me this answer. And so Daniel then he stuck his neck out. He stepped by faith. He said, I'll give you the interpretation. Now, then Daniel went to his house and made this thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret. Now notice, they didn't come demanding that God give them the answer. What did they ask for? Mercy. Folks, that's the only thing we can ask for when we come before God. You can't come before God saying, look what I did, and look how good I am, and look how wonderful and I am, and you know how much I've served you, and you know how hard I worked for you. Now do something. No way. No way do we approach God that way. And you look at the prayers of the Bible, and look at the Old Testament prayers, and look at the prayers of men like Nehemiah and Daniel later on. They accept the sins of the people as their own sins. And they confess the sins of the people just like it was my sin. And so Daniel here approaches God, and he said that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret. Now here's a secret. Only God can give it to them. And they're asking for mercy. Lord, if you don't give it to us, this is the end for us. And we don't plead righteousness. We don't plead justice. We ask for mercy. Have mercy. Oh, I want to tell you, that's what the Lord wants to hear when we come to prayer. Lord, have mercy. Have mercy. Have mercy. You know, it's so wonderful that our God is a God of mercy. Oh, he's a God of power. He's a God of wisdom. He's a God of knowledge. He's omnipotent. He's all these wonderful, glorious things. He's a God of love, but he's also a God of mercy. Isn't it wonderful that our God is a God of mercy? If he wasn't, you wouldn't be here tonight. You wouldn't be saved if he wasn't a God of mercy. And that's what we need, and that's what we need to cry out for. Mercy. God, be merciful. You know, Jesus said concerning that man that was in the temple praying, there were two of them praying, and one of them was telling the Lord how good he was, and how he paid his tithes, and how he did all these things, and that thing, and the other thing. And then the other one just simply smote upon his breast and said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. There's the sinner's prayer. That's the only prayer a sinner can pray. God, be merciful. We deserve to go to hell. We deserve the judgment of God. We don't deserve anything from him. We don't have any right to anything from him. And once we're his child, we have the right to come into his presence and claim promises and so forth. But as a sinner, it's just an old sinner out there, and so the cry is for mercy. God, be merciful. And we see that in the prayer. Now, verse 18, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, and Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, the question is, and there's no answer given in the book, I assume that when Daniel gave the answer, the rest of the wise men were spared, but I'm not sure of that at all, because the decree had gone out, and this is a different shift. This is the second shift, Daniel and his fellows before the king. It's not that first shift with all those men that he didn't trust. And this verse right here could very well say that the rest of them did perish. But anyway, verse 19, then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. God revealed to him the secret. He gave him the dream so that he would know what it was, and he gave him the interpretation of the dream. And boy, Daniel woke up praising God. And Daniel answered and said, first thing he did was not to run to the king. The first thing he did was to thank the Lord. Okay? When we get answers to prayer, you know, and God does something wonderful for us and answers prayer that we've been praying and seeking about, we ought to fall on our face, we ought to get on our knees, and the first person we ought to talk to is the Lord and tell him how grateful we are for his answer and how wonderful he is and how merciful he is and all those good things. Look here what he said. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. You see, what Daniel learned was that God is the God of history. He learned something that night from that vision. You know, it wasn't just that he got the vision, he got the interpretation of the vision. And it seems that it's the interpretation of the vision that has caught the attention of Daniel the most. For he says he changes the times and the seasons. There were four different kings in this dream. You know, he removeth kings and setteth up kings. God does it. God does it. He's the king setter up. He's the king maker. He puts one fellow on the throne, puts down another fellow.